This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, how will PNG's new treasurer propose to address what he calls the very deep economic hole? We'll have more on that and where Australia stands on budget assistance to PNG in just a moment. Also, reaction to news that Indonesia has effectively banned foreign diplomats and the United Nations from visiting the region of West Papua, and why PNG's corruption-tainted football association is still having funding from FIFA restricted, as another senior official has been banned from the game this week.
There's no funding for projects or for competitions that has not been coming. Until we comply today with areas of our governance of finance and other reporting matters.
More on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Well, when Papua New Guinea's new Prime Minister James Marape came to power earlier this year, he said that the country's economy was struggling and bleeding. The country's treasurer now says that it's worse than expected, and he's going to hand down a new budget today and plan to address what he calls the very deep economic hole that the country is in. As PNG tries to dig itself out of that hole, it is turning to Australia for help. With more, here's our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting.
Elma Yalan makes $4 to $9 a day selling fruit at a local market in Port Moresby. But she says this year has been harder than last.
Last year's sales were okay, but this year they're not. There's no money. We are sitting here but making no money.
Stephen Howes, a professor of economics with the Australian National University, says her experience reflects what's happening across the country. Signs of an economic recovery last year have quickly faded.
But unfortunately, you know, when you looked in more detail at the numbers for 2018, that spurt in growth was based on a big increase in government expenditure, and that increase itself couldn't be sustained.
The Treasurer, Ian Ling Stuckey, says it's worse than what was previously stated. In a statement, Mr. Ling Stuckey says there's a deficit of more than 2 billion Australian dollars. He's only been in the job for a few weeks after moving to government from opposition, where he was a vocal critic. He's blaming the former Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, for the deficit. Mr. O'Neill says the figures are nonsense. But Stephen Howes says he thinks Mr. Ling Stuckey's estimates are credible.
So there had been widespread suspicion in PNG that the previous government had been underestimating the extent of the fiscal and economic problems the country was facing. And he has now come out and said, yes, the previous numbers were misleading.
The Treasurer will hand down a supplementary budget today and has warned there will be cuts. PNG has also turned to Australia for help, and it appears it will get some support, possibly a loan. In a statement, Australia's Minister for International Development in the Pacific, Alex Hawke, said,
Papua New Guinea has asked Australia to consider providing short-term bridging finance and to help with its long-term economic reform priorities. Officials are making good progress. Further discussions will occur over the coming months.
While Australia has avoided direct budget involvement for years, Stephen Howes says a new reform program changes things.
So I think it'd be a great scenario for PNG and Australia if Australia can go ahead with the loan, you know, with the assurance of a World Bank or an IMF program. And that looks much more likely now.
PNG isn't ruling out also going to China for help as it tries to refinance almost $12 billion of debt. That remains a concern for Canberra. People like Elma Yalan also have concerns, but they're more straightforward.
I want to see change in the government so that things can operate as they should.
There are many people who agree with her.
There's Natalie Whiting reporting there from the PNG capital, Port Moresby. Well, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare has met with China's President Xi Jinping for the first time since his government controversially switched its diplomatic ties to recognise Beijing last month. And he's wasted no time in signing his country up to China's massive global infrastructure project known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Now, President Xi Jinping has told media that Solomon Islands' location will play a strategic role for China. Solomon Islands joins Fiji, PNG, Vanuatu and Kiribati now as countries in the Pacific that officially recognise China. The region, of course, has been somewhat caught up in that tussle between China and Taiwan. China, of course, recognises or believes that that Taiwan is a rogue breakaway province with no right to have its own state-to-state relations. Now, in this delegation this week, there are 32 people, all men, in fact, that Mr. Sogavare has been leading there in that trip to China. They're made up of politicians and businessmen. That is some of the welcome that Prime Minister Sogavare and his delegation have received. But while he's been out of the country, there have also been some quite substantial developments happening at home too. So for more on all of this, we're joined now by our reporter Evan Wasuga, who's been keeping a close eye on it for us. Firstly, Evan, to this trip by the Prime Minister to China, how significant is it for the country of Solomon Islands?
Well, Catherine, it's very significant. The act of Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare meeting China's President Xi Jinping is very important because it signals that, yes, Solomon Islands is now an ally of China. And more importantly, Sogavare has signed up Solomon Islands to the Belt and Road Initiative, which is all about infrastructure. And for the Solomon Islands government, one of its major reasons for switching to China was this aim to improve infrastructure, because this, it feels, is the key to enabling future development. So the optics of this visit are very important. But there's also been a lack of information about what exactly is Solomon Islands signing up to. There were several memorandums of understanding signed yesterday on education, economics, and technical cooperation. But there's been a lack of public information about what's on the table. In fact, we still don't know whether it'll be grants or loans that Solomon Islands will receive. There was a figure floated prior to the switch of US $500 million. But several weeks on, we haven't seen anything about that yet. Even the media who were traveling with the delegation to China don't have much information. They were part of the meeting with President Xi Jinping, but left after 5 minutes into the opening. Now, this lack of information is worrying for Solomon Islanders back home, who fear that this could worsen corruption and dissent. Dr. Anuk Ride is a researcher and lives and works in the Solomons.
You know, we really don't know what deals are either in progress or have already been made with China in relation to economic development. So, for example, we really don't know if there's been loans agreed to, if, you know, where and how certain projects are going to be rolled out, what the government and any bilateral partners are going to do to mitigate risks that come up with, for example, mining projects that use land and lease land from traditional landowners. All of these kind of things aren't really known. So the fear is in part about the fact that there's just a lack of transparency around the decision-making at the moment.
That's Dr. Anuk Ride. She's a researcher on peace and conflict in the Solomons. Now, while there's been a lack of information, there's actually movement already on the ground. This week, a team from China is in Honiara, and they're looking at designs of four national projects where they might be able to assist. Now, these are the 2023 Pacific Games Stadium, the National Hospital, National University, and a water treatment project. It's worth noting that two of those projects, the Pacific Games Stadium and the National Hospital, had Taiwan as the key donor. According to the Pacific Games hosting authority, China has committed to funding the Pacific Games Stadium, which will be the centerpiece for the 2023 Games, similar to Beijing's commitment to previous Games in Fiji and Samoa.
All right. Now, Evan, at the same time, we've also been seeing this week reports in Solomon Islands that an agreement between one of the provinces, Central Islands Province, and a Chinese company has been made. It's all about leasing some land in the province and also some of the resources and minerals. Have we been able to verify these reports?
Well, Catherine, this is a story that's been making headlines in the Solomons, and this agreement between Central Province and this Chinese corporation to lease portions of the province has had many people rattled. And when it was published yesterday, there were calls that this might be fake news. But here at the ABC Radio Australia, we've actually received a copy of that agreement. It's a four-page document for a strategic cooperation agreement that was signed on the 22nd of September. That's a week after Solomon Islands switched diplomatic ties to China. Now, in this document, the central province has agreed to put up its resources, land, seas, minerals, gas, while the Chinese corporation, Sam Enterprise, would invest in the province, including a lease on Tulagi Island, which happens to be the home of Solomon Islands' first capital. There's also a provision in that agreement to develop oil and gas terminal. Now, on the surface, it looks really one-sided with the province handing over its resources. But the key thing to keep in mind is that in the Solomons, the provincial government are not resource owners. They actually don't own the land unless it's registered to them. And in this case, it would be a small portion of land. And certainly, they don't own the seas or the minerals. All that is owned by the state or the national government. Land can be owned by tribes as well as forests. Now, the province simply doesn't have ownership of what it's signed up to, so there'll be plenty of legal questions around this document. I've sought comments from the Premier of Central Province, Sam Maniteva, who signed this agreement, but he's declined to be interviewed. As for the company in question, it's Sam Enterprise. We know it's a Chinese company. It's part of the China Morita Enterprise Group, which is part of a link which has links to the China National Chemicals, a state-owned enterprise with over 100,000 workers worldwide. The other big partner for Sam Enterprise is Morita Investment Group, a Japanese company. Now, on its website, Sam Enterprise Group says it strongly supports the Chinese government. In August, a delegation of Solomon MPs did visit the company's headquarters, and this was a group of MPs that were part of a task force investigating whether or not Solomon Islands should switch over from Taiwan to China.
All right, so plenty of questions still to be answered by authorities there in Solomon Islands. I'm sure things will come out in coming days. Thank you for that update. That's our reporter, Evan Wasuka.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Indonesia's effectively banned foreign diplomats and the United Nations from visiting the region of West Papua in the wake of the ongoing violence and unrest there. Now, the government in Jakarta says that security concerns prevent it from allowing access to both the foreign embassies or their citizens who want to visit the troubled Papua and West Papua provinces. With more, here's Anne Barker.
New Zealand's foreign ministry recently raised the violence in Papua with Indonesian authorities in Jakarta and sought permission to visit, saying it was, quote, deeply concerned by the ongoing unrest that has cost dozens of lives there since August. In the single worst attack at Wamena in central Papua province, 33 people were killed when locals angry at an alleged racial slur set homes and shops alight. Human Rights Watch believes around 8,000 people have since been displaced from their homes, and yet the organisation's Phil Robertson says no independent observers have been allowed into Papua to monitor the situation.
Well, unfortunately, Indonesia has blocked international media, diplomats, human rights monitors and others for decades. This is the de facto stance of the Indonesian government, and it raises some fundamental questions about what are they trying to hide.
The ABC has been told other embassies have made similar requests to visit Papua, and the United Nations Human Rights Office has been negotiating with Indonesia for months for access. But an Indonesian spokesman, Tuku Faizasia, confirms all foreign diplomats will be denied permission to visit Papua for the foreseeable future.
At the moment, the government tried to establish security and order in the provinces, and we want to make sure there is no possibility for incitement.
It's not only diplomats who've been blocked. Foreign journalists are now also banned because of the sensitivities about international coverage of the long-running independence campaign. And Indonesia has gone to great lengths to silence online commentary on Papua, even outside the country. An Australian activist who wants to remain anonymous says Twitter last week informed her that Indonesian authorities were demanding her Twitter account be deleted after she'd posted photos of some of the dead at Wamena.
I took it that Indonesia was threatening legal action towards Twitter based on my tweet.
And what was your reaction to this?
Well, I was a bit angry, but I also wasn't surprised. Based on what has happened with other accounts being hacked, other people having their pages taken down, I just assumed that it was probably going to happen anyway.
A human rights lawyer based in Jakarta, Veronica Koman, fled to Australia last month after Indonesia threatened her with charges and possible jail for posting videos and photos from inside Papua. Phil Robertson from Human Rights Watch predicts human rights abuses and deaths will continue in Papua unless Indonesia allows greater scrutiny.
Without any independent investigation to lay blame and to hold people accountable, we're going to see this repeat time and time again.
The ABC has sought comment from Australia's Foreign Affairs Department in Canberra.
That is Anne Barker reporting there from Jakarta in Indonesia. Well, as the blame game plays out in Kiribati following the release of a long-anticipated report into last year's deadly ferry disaster, which was the worst in the small island nation's history, one Pacific maritime expert says the tragedy is part of a much bigger issue in the region, and he's pointing the finger at donor partners, including Australia, for what he says has been ad hoc assistance to the Pacific's shipping industry. Meanwhile, Pacific Beat can reveal that the Commission of Inquiry believes that a business deal that involved a Member of Parliament in Kiribati was one of the reasons why so many passengers boarded the ill-fated MV Busaroy, despite the fact that it wasn't meant to be carrying anyone at all. In Kiribati, like so much of the Pacific, inter-island ferries are critical. The MV Busaroy, in fact, that sank last year, killing 95 people, had been a community-driven project that was funded more than a decade ago by the government of Taiwan. Its price tag, just under $400,000. For Dr. Peter Nuttall, who's a maritime technical advisor based in Fiji, that's where its problems began.
You try building that in Australia and New Zealand for $400,000 and put it through survey and provide all the safety equipment and then maintain it in an uneconomic route. It's an impossible task, we're asking.
Dr. Nuttall assisted with the early stages of an investigation by Kiribati maritime authorities into the disaster. He's also read the Commission of Inquiry report that was finally made public this month and was scathing of the ferry's master in particular.
Made a number of critical errors. The operator probably made an even larger number of errors. I suspect that there was enormous pressure being placed both on the operator and on the captain to overload that vessel.
That's something Juanita Limpus believes too.
Maybe people were asking to get on the boat and he didn't know how to say no to them.
She's the co-founder of the Australian Kiribati Association and is based in Brisbane. But she also lost a nephew in the tragedy.
Maybe something good comes out of it. Maybe the people will have to be educated to follow the rules as well, not just the operators of the boat.
Pacific Beat can reveal that the Commission of Inquiry has detailed how the ferry's operator offered free travel for passengers as a way for it to pay a debt off to a local businessman who was also an MP. It suggests that
people took advantage of the free passage and boarded the boat in large numbers, quite audaciously, daring and unhindered, to the point of being unstoppable by both master and crew. The result was a disaster.
Pacific Beat has provided a series of questions to the Kiribati government on this and other elements of the report, but have so far not received a response. Now, the report only made one recommendation relating to that particular finding, but it was vague, suggesting that public office holders and MPs must recognise any negative impacts there may be on the constituencies because of campaigning. For Dr. Peter Nuttall, though, while he's glad to see the various recommendations that have been made, he says the solution needs to go beyond specific Pacific nations and their governments.
Really, is putting new regulations in place and some new systems really going to solve this problem, or is it just tinkering around the edges? These disasters have happened regularly throughout our past. I'm predicting they're going to happen in the future. It's a simple sort of equation. We end up in this continuous cycle of little aid projects, throwing a boat in here and a boat in there, no real coordination behind that, inadequate investment anyway.
Dr. Nuttall points to Australia's multi-million dollar Pacific Patrol Boat Program that will see 21 new boats handed over to 12 Pacific countries to help them improve surveillance of their maritime waters.
There's a $700 million investment by the Australian government in the area of maritime security. But what's the point of having, you know, the best patrol boats in the world if we've got the worst transport services? And the people that are suffering most from this are the most remote and the most vulnerable.
Australia's Foreign Affairs Department is yet to provide a response to those claims. The president of PNG's Football Association says that money from the world ruling body FIFA that's meant to support the game in the country is still being restricted following the sport's very troubled recent history. The PNG FA has this year, of course, had new management after a corruption scandal that's still creating issues, it appears. Just this week, the senior vice president, John Wesley Gonduin, was suspended for almost 3 years by FIFA for financial wrongdoing that was linked to when PNG hosted the under-20 Women's World Cup back in 2016. Now, PNG FA's former president, David Chung, was also found guilty of corruption earlier this year, and he was suspended from the game for more than 6 years. Richard Ewart spoke with the man who has replaced David Chung, John Caponato.
We have a situation now where your predecessor, David Chung, is serving a lengthy FIFA ban. We also have Ty Nicholas, of course, who was David Chung's second-in-command at OFC. And now we have John Wesley in Papua New Guinea serving nearly a three-year ban. As far as PNG are concerned, are you satisfied, if you like, that that's the end of it now? Or do you think there could still be more skeletons in the cupboard?
I wouldn't say right now that I know that something was going to be uncovered. I leave that to FIFA because FIFA continues to do its own audits and checks and balances through PNGFA, and we're open to them. I mean, right now, this month and next month, we're still complying to them on issues that they want. So we're continuing doing that. On the FIFA under 20, they've done their own investigation on that, audits on that, and comes with the consequences of that, as we've seen Mr. John Wesley facing his faith on the compliance on that. So it may come up. Somebody may be called on for that. That's with FIFA. I can't draw a conclusion on that.
And as far as the funding is concerned for the PNGFA from FIFA, is the funding flowing now? Are you getting everything to which you're entitled?
No. Since my election in November of 2018, there's no funding for projects or for competitions that has not been coming. But the only funding that FIFA ensure that our employees are working and they're being paid, yeah, we have a monthly allowance that FIFA assists PNGFA, but not to an extent of giving us all our funding in whatever projects that we want to do and support our national team or support our gears and our uniforms, our coaching, technical. All those fundings have been restricted until we comply to them with areas of our governance of finance and other reporting matters that we are continuing on today, working with our statutes of our MAs. Those are going back to FIFA, so that I think they want to make sure that we are in good hands.
It's John Caponato. He's the president of the PNG Football Association, speaking there with Richard Ewart. Well, finally this morning, today is Fiji Day, where they're celebrating 49 years since the country gained independence from Great Britain. It's also being marked, though, by many in the Fiji diaspora who now call Australia home. The numbers of Fijians living in Australia has certainly been growing in recent years. There are now estimated to be just under 100,000 who live here. And given Fiji's population back at home stands at around 900,000, that is quite a significant figure. And as Roseanne Maloney reports, some of those celebrating here in Australia say that by marking the day, they're able to ensure that they don't disconnect from Fijian culture.
It's a day of celebrations for all those who identify as Fijian, and for those who don't, to learn about the cultures that call Fiji home. For many people, Fiji Day is also centred around building connections with the Fijian community. President of the Fijian Community Association, Sylvia Coombe.
According to history, it was that Fiji moving away from the British. But not only that, it was meant to symbolise the unity of both Fijians and Indians living in Fiji as one.
In previous years, tensions between Indigenous Fijians and Fijians of Indian descent were hostile, following a culture of several military coups in the country. The culture was motivated by parties who either wished to reduce or increase the rights of Fijians of Indian descent.
We're still quite disconnected from each other in terms of groups. Our association tries to hold this type of events to actually try and connect some of the members from all those other groups so that we all benefit from it.
She says the day is also about connecting Fijians in Australia with their home. The Fijian community in Melbourne will celebrate Fiji Day later this month. Stallholder Viliame Rangaugau will be cooking traditional Fijian food. He says sharing food teaches people and younger Fijians about home.
Our young kids, they come up and they see how it's done. It just reminds us our culture and our tradition. It identifies who we are.
Liame says he also looks forward to the food from other Fijian cultures.
It's going to be a few different food stalls, not forgetting our other Fijian families who are here in Australia. They're also going to be cooking their own dishes.
Fiji Day celebrations in Sydney have similar aims. Fijian of Indian descent, Barbara Ward, says her event aims to connect communities and cultures.
It's just a day for everyone, really. It really doesn't matter what heritage we have. It's just the Independence Day and everybody just comes together and celebrate.
The event committee member hopes the Fijian Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, will come to their event again this year. He has attended their celebrations in Sydney in the past.
I think it's absolutely wonderful. It shows the Fijians that the Prime Minister takes this quite seriously and wants to be with his people, even though they are not in Fiji.
Well, that was Roseanne Maloney reporting there. That is all for Pacific Beats this morning. I will be back, of course, at the same time tomorrow morning. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because, of course, Pacific Mornings continues up next.